WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dragoon. Trump just told Americans not to comply with any upcoming virus-related mandates. Tucker suggests that those in charge may start a world war to keep from losing power in 2024. And the judge presiding over the Georgia Trump trial is opening it up to TV cameras. But first, the harsh sentence a federal judge just handed down to two Proud Boys for their actions on January 6 has Americans talking about our unjust justice system. The 17-year prison sentence for Joseph Biggs and 15-year sentence for Zachary Rell are the second and third longest J6-related sentences handed so far. Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes got 18 years for seditious conspiracy back in May. Biggs tore down a fence meant to keep people from getting to the Capitol. Federal prosecutors were trying to get him sentenced to double the time he actually received. U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly had accepted the DOJ's recommendation to add a terrorism enhancement to both men's sentences, which significantly increased their prison time. Biggs and Rell were found guilty in May of seditious conspiracy, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to use force, intimidation or threats to prevent officers of the United States from discharging their duties, interference with law enforcement during civil disorder, and destruction of government property. If you think the sentence is harsh, you're not alone. Writing for American Thinker, Monica Showalter said this: apparently, this guy knocked over a fence on January 6 and communicated with his like-minded buddies about real men, and that was enough to trigger the judge, who slapped terrorism enhancements onto the man's crime, putting it in the same league as what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed did to the Pentagon and World Trade Center on 9/11. In a sentencing memo filed with the court on August 17, defense attorney Norman Pattis described the sentences as shocking and a grotesque overreach that's designed to chill dissent. Defendants are not terrorists, he wrote. Whatever excesses of zeal they demonstrated on January 6, 2021, and no matter how grave the potential interference with the orderly transfer of power due to events of that day, a decade or more behind bars is an excessive punishment. Here is Daily Wire's Andrew Klavan noticing the vast difference in how the justice system treats lawbreakers on the right versus those on the left.
The leader of the Proud Boys, who was at January 6th, just got sentenced to 17 years in prison because he tore down a fence and the judge said this was an act of terrorism. And that was half of what the government was asking for. The government was asking for like 33 years in prison. However, two lawyers who firebombed a police car during the violent riots over George Floyd's death in New York got just a little over a year, 12 months, I think, and 14 months. The guy who burned down a police precinct in Minneapolis got 4 years.
Join me to discuss today's stories is executive senior editor of the New American Magazine, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Paul.
So that's obviously something that most people are thinking. And how was burning down police stations, police cars, and entire cities not ruled an act of terrorism? And maybe this is, maybe it's not, but it's like those others weren't.
Well, you know, I mean, the fundamental purpose of law and order and the justice system has always been, of course, to disincentivize criminal behavior, antisocial behavior. Everyone knows that you can't prevent it outright. So the next best thing is, well, you know, to make sure that people who do things like, say, murder or sedition or rape or other, you know, acts of violence and fraud and so forth are made examples of, so to speak, so that people know, well, if I do that, this is what's going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. Now, anyone with two eyes can see what's going on here. I mean, we have a litany of offenses by people on the left, violent offenses, of, you know, stretching back to the beginning of the Trump administration at least, in which, you know, people, as was mentioned just now in the B-roll, that, you know, these people do, you know, commit acts of violence and arson and so forth, attacks. Left unmentioned, all the people committed assault on camera, yeah, assaulted bystanders, all this sort of thing during those riots.
Assaulting police
these
officers.
These various spasms of riots. And they get, you know, slaps on the wrist. So it's very clear the message that's being sent. The message that's being sent now is that all crime has been politicized, well, all violent crime anyway, has been politicized and, if I can coin the term, ideologized. Okay, so in other words, if you commit a violent act, but you have the right ideology, meaning the left ideology is what's motivating you, then you're going to be given, you know, a tisk tisk, shouldn't do that. The implication being is it's okay, you know, what you're doing and thinking, but just don't take it too far. On the other hand, if your views are from the so-called right,
yeah,
then even relatively mild acts of disruption, like, as they mentioned, you know, jumping over a fence, smashing a window or something like that, become occasion for the heaviest of heavy hands of justice to come down. So there's clearly a double standard, and it's clearly – and it shows exactly what's going to happen if the radical left achieves what it's almost achieved already, which is permanent entrenchment and ascendancy over the American legal system. Because they've done it before. Every time they've come to power, from the French Revolution onward, this is what they do.
Yeah. So I think many advocates, or those who may say this isn't that harsh, will point out to the fact that, or I don't think it's a fact, but they'll say that what this really is about is that they were trying to stop the transfer of power, whereas apparently those who are just burning cities, they were just trying to destroy all power or whatever. I don't know what they say about this, but does that make a difference if, in fact, that's, you know, what they were trying to do was stop the transfer
okay.
of power?
Fine. So let's grant that that's the case.
Right.
Then how are the rioters who committed acts of looting and arson, nearly lynched a couple of, Ted Cruz and so forth, right outside the White House itself in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., who made it clear from the day that Trump was elected president that they did not regard him as their president, that they were going to engage in acts of resistance and not just passive civil disobedience or whatever, but violent resistance, which was carried out again and again at MAGA rallies, attacking and assaulting people. I remember one time returning to home in Tucson via Phoenix, Arizona. All the traffic was jammed because Trump was in Phoenix,
yeah,
and there was a riot.
Right.
The riot, and I had friends that went there, and they said, "Yeah, I mean, they feared for their lives because they were being pressed about." So that was a concerted effort, not of a single day, okay, but of 4 years plus, to subvert and destroy and bring down by any means necessary an entire administration duly elected by the American people.
Great point. I got one last question before we move on to the story. Do you happen to know if Trump were to somehow get in the White House, could he pardon these folks? Could he get them out of jail early?
No, undoubtedly he could.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Let's look at our next story. With COVID cases rising, some hospitals and schools are bringing back mask mandates. The last time this happened, millions of Americans trusted the white coats and they complied. They also largely comply with other COVID mandates, including the lockdowns and the COVID shots. But if the mandates come roaring back, will there be more resistance this time? Well, that's what Donald Trump is encouraging. Here's what he had to say in a video his team posted Wednesday on X.
The left-wing lunatics are trying very hard to bring back COVID lockdowns and mandates with all of their sudden fear-mongering about the new variants that are coming. Gee whiz, you know what else is coming? An election. They want to restart the COVID hysteria so they can justify more lockdowns, more censorship, more illegal drop boxes, more mail-in ballots, and trillions of dollars in payoffs to their political allies heading into the 2024 election. Does that sound familiar? These are bad people. These are sick people we're dealing with. But to every COVID tyrant who wants to take away our freedom, hear these words: we will not comply. So don't even think about it. We will not shut down our schools. We will not accept your lockdowns. We will not abide by your mask mandates. And we will not tolerate your vaccine mandates. They rigged the 2020 election, and now they're trying to do the same thing all over again by rigging the most important election in the history of our country, the 2024 election, even if it means trying to bring back COVID. But they will fail because we will not let it happen. When I'm back in the White House, I will use every available authority to cut federal funding to any school, college, airline, or public transportation system that imposes a mask mandate or a vaccine mandate.
This is different from what Trump sounded like as president. Here he is at a press conference on March 16, 2020, when he announced new COVID guidelines.
My administration is recommending that all Americans, including the young and healthy, work to engage in schooling from home when possible, avoid gathering in groups of more than 10 people, avoid discretionary travel, and avoid eating and drinking at bars, restaurants, and public food courts.
It could be that Trump, like many other Americans, has learned a lot since 2020. Florida Surgeon General Joseph Latipo is another influential voice against the reintroduction of mask mandates. On August 24th, he posted on X, "What do you call reimposing mask policies that have been proven ineffective or restarting lockdowns that are known to cause harm? You don't call it sanity. These terrible policies only work with your cooperation. How about refusing to participate?" Okay, Steve, so I found it interesting that Latipo used mental health terms because even the CDC admitted in October of 2020, which was just a few months later, that the restrictions, all that stuff, was actually causing adverse mental health conditions. Yeah, it was making people crazy. So what do you think? Is it going to be different this time?
Well, first of all, I mean, during a pandemic, if we can call it that, there are no good choices. People are going to get sick and in some cases die one way or the other. So, I mean, you know, the question is which path do you choose to follow? As you may know, I and my family spent our time in the pandemic in China. We were there when it started. We experienced one of the most severe lockdowns in human history in the city of Shanghai. And it was so extreme that, yeah, they managed for a while to prevent COVID from spreading at the rate that it spread in the West. But in the end, but now, you know, look at what's going on in China.
They're suffering because they have no immunity, right?
Well, sure, they have no immunity. And of course, in the end, they finally had to give up when the Omicron strain, which was just spread too quickly, was too contagious. There we go. But in any case,
I'm the linguist today.
I'm having a Mitch moment this morning. I'm going to call these Mitch moments from now on, so senior moments, yeah, in honor of Mitch McConnell. But anyway, yeah, that's terrible. I know. I'm a horrible person. But in any event, But in the short run, it appears, you know, these measures can have, I mean, if you literally physically isolate everyone from everyone else, you know, ipso facto, it's impossible for the disease to spread. Of course, if you do that, people are all going to starve because no one can go shopping. Yeah. No one, their commerce ceases. I mean, if you literally make everyone go out and maintain 1 mile distance from everyone else or something like that, yeah, you can do that, but most people are going to starve. So that's the price that you're going to pay.
Yeah.
And this is what people learned, you know, during the, obviously a variety of approaches were tried way back in the Middle Ages during the Black Death pandemic, ditto with the Spanish flu, influenza pandemic a little over a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a difficulty because it poses these problems because unlike an earthquake or a storm, a hurricane or something like this, where it's a one-off event and then you're left dealing with the mess afterwards, a pandemic kind of goes on and on and on. And people feel like, well, we need to be in problem-solving mode. And a certain number of people always think, well, let's turn to the government. Because after all, the government will help us if there are economic problems, if there's an earthquake or some other natural disaster. But pandemics are unique because of their duration, because of their power to pit people against one another. And we saw that here in the United States. However,
what do you think of Trump's
however, in
turnaround?
The long run, we are now, we and the broader Western world, that at least those portions that didn't adopt these sort of extreme policies that were tried by, you know, the People's Republic of China, are better off.
Yeah. What do you think of Trump's turnaround? Because he gets a lot of crap from the right for this, and rightfully so. My opinion is that, like many other things, Trump was goaded into just by advisors into making bad choices. There's nothing suggesting that he really did the research or anything like that. And now he realizes that wasn't a good move.
Well, you know, I mean, Trump has to own the mistakes that he made. Okay, so number one, let's not forget that all these vaccines were part of his, you know, part of his program in the first
Operation
place.
Operation Warp Speed, we remember him bragging
about
it.
Yeah, it seems to be a little bit disingenuous of him to be talking about, you know, how these terrible vaccines and all this, the vaccine mandates and so forth. But, you know, he was the one. And again, obviously, you know, I mean, wisdom is always 20/20 in hindsight. We look back and say, oh, we should have done this and should have done that, you know. But no one knew how severe the pandemic was going to be, how long it was going to last, realistically. But the science was pretty clear in this case. The science was, you know, to develop an even halfway workable vaccine typically requires 10, 15, 20 years. It's a long process of trial and error.
And we got it in 6 months, baby.
Yeah, and right. And there's just really no way to take shortcuts.
We're still suffering
for
it years and years later. We're living through the trials, unfortunately. Thanks, Steve. Well, folks, we are just days away from the John Birch Society's Leadership Conference. And while the early bird ticket window is closed, you can still get tickets and join us. The event kicks off on Friday in Des Moines, Iowa, where we'll be discussing ways to be part of the massive movement working to restore our wonderful nation. This will also be a great opportunity for us to meet you and for you to meet other like-minded patriots. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ryan Cole, who will be discussing the death of science, medical freedom in an era of lies. Other speakers include James Patrick, the film director of the movie Nitrogen 2000, former Iowa U.S. Congressman Steve King, election expert Dr. Douglas Frank, and the New Americans, Alex Newman. You can learn more about the conference, and you can get your tickets to the conference at jbs.org. If you prefer, you can also call and get your tickets at 1-800-527-8721. Again, get your tickets at jbs.org or by calling 1-800-527-8721. Stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more Truth Behind the News.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Welcome back. So what kind of election year dirty tricks might the Biden administration and the Democrats resort to if they can't destroy Trump? How far will they go on to hold on to power? In a recent interview with Adam Carolla, Tucker Carlson had a chilling answer. They might start an open war with Russia. Let's listen.
What are they going to do? They're going to go to war with Russia is what they're going to do. There will be a hot war between the United States and Russia in the next year.
And really?
Yes, of course. They want it anyway. I don't think we'll win it. But that's a separate analysis. But I think as a political matter, they need to declare war footing in order to assume war powers in order to win. I believe that. And I think the evidence suggests that's true. We're already at war with Russia, of course. We're funding their enemies. So we're fighting Russia. But I mean, an open battle with Russia where we say we're at war with Russia. Yeah. I think we could Tonkin Gulf our way into it, where all of a sudden missiles land in Poland. The Russians did it. Our NATO allies been attacked. We're going to war. I could see that happening very easily.
Given what we've already seen from the radical left and its Democrat enablers, Tucker's bleak prediction doesn't seem too far-fetched. After all, they've already declared open season on a large sector of the American population, evident in the manufactured riots and attacks against MAGA supporters and increasing legal and political persecution. And on Thursday, Judge Scott McAfee of the Superior Court of Fulton County, Georgia, ruled that Trump's trial will be televised and that people can bring cell phones, recording devices, and laptops into court. If the order holds, the Georgia trial will be the only one of the four indictments that will be televised. This is more support for the idea that these indictments are for show. But the leftist punditry class, some of them at least, sees this as an opportunity for you to be enlightened. Here's former lead so-called investigator Timothy Heffey on CNN talking about just that.
I think it's a really big deal
because even though it's going to be the same facts that America has heard repeatedly from the Select Committee, from very aggressive reporting by a lot of really good journalists, there's a chance that the same facts will resonate more when they are presented in a different forum, right? I think there are people out there in this country that don't trust Congress because it's politicized. They don't trust the media. They might trust a criminal proceeding where that same evidence is tested by vigorous advocacy on behalf of the former president and his co-conspirators. So if America can see the same evidence play out in that forum, I think, maybe naively, but legitimately, it has a chance to resonate and connect and change minds in a way that maybe some of the other presentations of that evidence did not succeed.
Okay, Steve, so this guy's a true believer. I think he's actually genuine about, you know, he believes that Trump is, his true colors are going to show out.
Well, notice the very subtle comment, Trump and his co-conspirators. The word alleged was omitted, and not by accident, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Normally, journalese, we talk about people who haven't been convicted. We say, alleged this and alleged
right.
or the accused this and accused that. But not in the case of Trump.
Isn't the chances greater that this is gonna backfire on them, just like that mugshot?
It's possible. I mean, it depends what you mean by backfire. I mean, what is absolutely, pelucidly clear.
Well, by backfire, he's thinking that people are going to watch and they're like,
No.
Now I'm convinced.
What it's saying is, it's okay. So it's very clear that the people we refer to as the radical left, and by the way, in our upcoming show this week on Friday, we're going to try to go into depth to really define who these people are. What does that actually mean? We throw this term around, but what does it mean? Anyway, the radical left, you know who you are. They clearly have a stranglehold on the U.S. judicial system. And we kind of mentioned that in the previous segment where we talked about the disproportionate penalties of different, you know, not all rioting and not all violence apparently is the same, you know. And so the same is manifestly true in these Trump cases. So so they clearly already have the control that they've long coveted over pretty much every instrument except for the Supreme Court itself, every institution, I should say, and maybe a few of the circuit courts, some police forces, but the degree of control, entrenched control enjoyed by these radicals is, can't be overstated. And they don't want to lose that control. And I don't see, frankly, any imminent danger of that happening, okay? The only thing that could happen is, you know, there could be a popular backlash. But quite frankly, what are the people going to do about it at this point, given the fact that the judiciary is firmly under their control, given the fact that the outcome of elections, they've demonstrated now that they have ascendancy over the electoral system in many key states. So I don't know. I don't mean to sound negative, but it certainly is. It's not clear what's going to happen because people have been angry about this. Polls show this.
Yes.
There's already been plenty of backlash, and it has amounted to bupkis.
Right. Well, I guess I'm going to take the flip side of the coin that guy is, you know, talking about. And I'm going to say, well, maybe some people on the left or center left are going to watch this and they're like, huh, those Trump people are right. This is unjust. Now, let's go to that back to the other story, because Tucker Carlson is, I guess he's predicting, or he sounds pretty sure he does that, you know, that's how Tucker talks, but it's not a crazy scenario, is it, that they would use war? Like he said, a lot of the actions, for instance, there was a peace treaty on the table, correct me if I'm wrong, that we pushed Boris Johnson to go over there and scrap. There are other actions that we've taken, all indicative of the fact that we want this war. What do you think?
Well, this is not without precedent, even in American history. He mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin incident. A more recent incident that has gone down the memory hole.
The 70s, LBJ.
No, even more recent than that. Within living memory, it's been completely memory-holed. And this is Operation Desert Fox. For those who've forgotten, Operation Desert Fox was a one-week-long air war that Bill Clinton unleashed against Iraq literally on the night before his impeachment by the House of Representatives. And at the time, it was very clear what he was doing. He was starting a war in the Middle East as a way to try to intimidate the people who were impeaching him. Okay. And a number of Republicans, you can go, if you go back, it's probably most of it's been scrubbed from YouTube and the internet by now, but there were a number of congressmen, GOP, of course, expressing solicitude that the president was at this point, at that point, mentally unstable, and they were getting scared. They weren't sure what he might try to do using his powers as commander in chief to stave off this. So, you know, but going further back in history, the French revolutionaries did the same thing. People always, everybody knows about the Napoleonic Wars. What they don't know is that, so at least not so many people are aware of this, is that the radical left who took over revolutionary France, when things got too bad domestically, the chaos got worse and worse, they invaded, you know, the Low Countries. They invaded other places in an attempt to export their revolution. And but obviously, I mean, that was the stated goal, but the real goal was to divert domestic attention from what was going on. Argentina tried the same thing back in the early 80s. The military junta was falling apart because of, you know, hyperinflation and other problems. So they started a war with Great Britain over the Malvinas, over the Falkland Islands, and that didn't work out too well for Argentina. So this is something that people in power are willing to do. It happens frequently in history. The old ploy of, in the words of Shakespeare, cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. So I'm not saying that Tucker's necessarily right, because in this case, obviously a war with Russia could have far more severe consequences given Russia's nuclear arms and all this kind of thing. And probably, I mean, you know, Putin's kind of is a nut job too. Yeah. And I think in the final analysis, he and Medvedev and the rest of his inner circle would probably be willing to use nuclear arms against the West.
You really think that?
I do.
Surely they must know it would come back at them.
They do, but we don't have time to talk about this too much. But Putin, right before the war with Ukraine started, when he was still massing troops, in one interview he was asked, "Well, aren't you afraid if you invade Ukraine, it'll bring about like a World War III?" And his response was interesting. He said words to the effect, and this is not propaganda from CNN. I saw the interview. You know, he actually said this, but it wasn't really noted at the time because most people at that time still didn't believe that he would do such an audacious thing. But he said, you know, I don't care if it comes to that, because he said, you know, we'll send our missiles to them and they'll send us, and we will all go to paradise and they'll all go to the hell that they deserve to go to, or words to that effect. See, people forget that Putin is, at least
in some
degree,
religious.
He's a bit of a religious fanatic.
Is he?
Yeah.
Is he Orthodox?
I mean, at least he poses as one. And, you know, that's part of his shtick. And that doesn't necessarily mean he's not also a cynical, you know, internationalist insider, you know, genocidal maniac, all the rest of it. But he definitely, there is an element of religious fanaticism involved.
Yeah.
In this case,
he hasn't shown that too strongly.
No, not so much. But that's clearly one of the things that he has in his mind. So I think he's capable of doing it. And I think, you know, I don't think that Tucker is necessarily correct when he says we would lose such a war.
Yeah.
No one really knows the answer to that. Tucker, as you say, has this way of being very poised and cocksure about everything.
Yeah.
And then
that's a style. It's not always.
Right. But the thing is, I mean, we've already seen, you know, we have been, you know, as the meme goes on Facebook, you know, recent history is the longest, saddest, I told you so, in human history. People like us have been warning for decades what would happen if we allowed these amoral, radical, power-hungry leftists to assume control of our system.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that it's basically in place, we see the lengths to which they're willing to go. We've mentioned, you know, the cynical exploitation of COVID. We've mentioned in today's episode what they're doing to Donald Trump and his co-conspirators. So it's not really clear if there's anything beyond the moral compass of what they're willing to do.
Yeah. And people, I think what's hard for us normal people, and I feel like I bring this up every time, what's hard for us to understand is that the people who have the power to make this happen, they don't care about human lives like we think about. It's like, man, war. It's like, you got to make sure before you send people in. It's like, I don't think they care, do they? I mean,
well,
obviously.
A large number of them are clinical psychopaths and sociopaths.
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, we aren't just talking about Democrats here.
Yeah.
There are some people who are nonpartisan and so forth. But these people that we label the insiders, the deep state, the globalists, and all the rest of it, these people are not normal people.
Yeah.
Okay, they would be no more amenable to coming over and having a backyard party, playing turkey bowl with you on Thanksgiving, than would, you know, some serial killer on death row.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. Thank you, Steve. That's all for our news segment today, folks. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure you get yourself a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783 Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And stay tuned, because we will be right back with more Truth Behind the News.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Next up, Christian Gomez interviews Selwyn Duke about how the transgender revolution is the next phase of the 60s feminist revolution and where this revolution is going. Let's listen.
This is Christian Gomez with the New American Magazine, and we're joined today on the program with Selwyn Duke, author and contributor for the New American Magazine. Selwyn, thank you for joining us today on the program. It's good to have you on.
Christian, always good to be with you. It's been a while with our vacations, huh?
Yeah, but we're back at it. So where are we today? I believe you want to discuss feminism and how it relates to what the left calls the transgender movement.
Yeah, well, we have a very interesting story here, Christian, that I wrote about this week, and it concerns this chief psychologist who actually says that children can be, quote, gender minotaurs or gender Priuses. Now, what does that mean? Well, a minotaur was a sort of a hybrid, and a Prius is a hybrid, so these kids could be gender hybrids, and she hails this, her name is Diane Ehrensaft, as the next revolution in gender theory, I guess. That's sort of how she puts it. She thinks it's a wonderful thing. And not only that, if that's not insane enough, she apparently takes her lead, Christian, from young children, because she said that she learned about the gender minotaurs, I think, while talking to a seven-year-old in her office, that a child can be a gender minotaur. And then she talked about another kid, a young boy who twirled, as they put it, in her office and said, look, I'm a gender Prius. I'm a boy in front and a girl in back, so a child shall lead them.
I highly doubt that a child came up with those terms, but nevertheless, that's their story. So I guess for the sake of the argument, we could just run with it for now. So the children would become hybrid what? A Prius, obviously, is a, you know, hybrid fuel energy. You know, renewable energy with either electric powered with gasoline or ethanol with gasoline, and minotaur part man, part horse. What are these gender minotaurs supposed to be?
Yeah, well, I think that she's using minotaur and Prius as sort of a metaphor. She's just saying that these kids could be hybrids. You don't have to be a boy or a girl. You can be whatever you want to be. It's that old thing, which unfortunately now is not a new idea, I guess. But, you know, this harks back to something G.K. Chesterton said. He called common sense, quote, that forgotten branch of psychology. And now we're seeing that psychology is just proving him right. He said that about 100 years ago. It never ceases to do so. And now we have coming out of psychology what a lot of people would call uncommon senselessness. This is just a great example. And like I said, I mean, this woman is actually a psychologist, I'm reading here, and the director of mental health for the Child and Adolescent Gender Center at UCSF's Benioff Children's Hospital. So this is a prominent person. This is not someone who just has some small little position. But it's very interesting. You know, there are many ways we could go with this. But there's something she said that actually is true, Christian, and it really caught my eye because it's a point that I've been making for years, and it's this. She said, I'm quoting Fox now, quote, believes the transgender revolution is the next phase of the 60s feminist movement, which featured challenging stereotypes about gender. Think about that, and I'll elaborate, but I'll just cede the floor to you if you have anything to say about that.
Well, back in the 60s, the feminist movement, as you pointed out from that quote, was trying to challenge the traditional gender roles. So in television shows, for example, you often saw men in leadership roles and women in secretarial roles. And then in the 60s, that began to change with seeing women having the same kind of roles as men. And, of course, we've seen this for decades. But now they want to go further than that. That was just a step in their radical transgender direction. So the next phase to them, this is an ongoing revolution, a sexual revolution, is to take children and pervert their minds, destroy them into becoming something that they're not. So can you delve further into that?
Yeah. I've been making this point for years, and that's why Aaron Saft's statement really caught my eye. Because see, Christian, here's the whole thing. A lot of people are saying, including conservatives, well, this is terrible. They're erasing women. This is an attack upon women. And even some feminists like Kara Dansky, most feminists, I guess, are quiet about this. But people like her, they'll go on TV and they'll actually say this is sort of like a men's rights movement. This is about men who want to impose themselves upon women. And they're completely oblivious, apparently, to the fact that feminism laid the foundation for this. Now, let me explain why very, very clearly. Feminism stated for decades that the sexes were the same except for the superficial physical differences. And consequently, according to them, if you raised boys and girls identically, they would end up being the same. Now, why did they do this? They did this because it was convenient, because the thinking, Christian, was, well, if people believe the sexes are the same and that the differences are only skin deep, then there's no reason to prescribe different roles for the sexes. There's no reason to say women can't be in the military, women can't be on police forces, women can't do anything a man can do. There's no reason to suppose their capabilities might be different. It was very, very convenient when the feminists and the left in general wanted to break down walls and traditions. But here's the problem with that, okay? It leads to what I call the MUS agenda, made up sexual status agenda. I don't call it transgenderism because we must control the language. Why does it lead to it? Well, it's very, very simple. Again, the feminists said the sexes are the same except for the superficial physical differences. Then the MUS activists came along and they said, okay, well then, if you change the superficial physical differences, you can be the opposite sex. All you need to do is have these gender reassignment surgeries. You make yourself look like a woman if you're a man. You grow your hair longer. You have your Adam's apple altered. You have other parts of your body altered. You change those superficial physical differences. And then according to the feminists, well, what they've said, a corollary is you can be the opposite sex. So the feminists absolutely laid the foundation for the destruction of women's sports, which now some of them lament. And by the way, I know I'm going on here a bit, but when I say that they were pressing this idea of the sameness of the sexes, let me illustrate for you how insistent they were. Camille Paglia, who's a feminist and a self-described lesbian, but she often expresses common sense and defends some traditional ideas. She related a story, Christian, in an interview in which she said that in the 1970s, feminists would corner her on college campuses, glaring at her, and they would swear up and down that hormones didn't even exist. And even if they did, they couldn't possibly influence behavior.
They must That's have been psychology prevalent. Majors.
Yeah, many of them probably. Yeah, I don't know if they had gender studies back then per se, but absolutely. So this is something, listen, that I was inundated with growing up. I never believed in it, but it absolutely was the feminist line that, hey, the sexes are basically the same until the MUS individuals, the MUS men came along and started invading women's spaces. And then all of a sudden, some feminists said, wait a second, right now is not a good idea to push this notion because now it's being used to take opportunities away from women. We meant for it to give opportunities to women. But either way, it's a lie, and lies always have short legs. They always come back to haunt you.
Absolutely. Ironically, this is coming from the same crowd that would say things like, trust the science, or, you know, believe science and not superstition. And this is the same crowd that in the name of defending women and advancing the rights of women, and in the name of empowering women, they're virtually, as you're explaining, destroying womanhood, destroying women activities. Anything that defines a woman, they're essentially destroying it. So what is that going to leave society with? A confused bunch of people who have no idea what they are, or whatever feels good to them. It determines what they identify for the moment. I mean, where does this end? What does it lead to?
Yeah, well, you know, there's so much we could say about this, because even if you just look at what this psychology professor, Aaron Saft, had to say herself, what she says just reeks of moral relativism and the rejection of truth, and truth, of course, meaning something objective and transcendent. And I guess we can't get too deeply into that. But you're seeing here society's rejection of absolutes. Absolute truth doesn't exist, the left will tell us, and unfortunately many conservatives believe that now too. Consequently, who's to say what's right or wrong? It's whatever works for you, and that's been used as a pretext for destroying tradition. And now it's being applied to even things such as sex, as in the characteristic or the quality of being male or female. But, you know, let me just say something else about what the feminists did here. They even, for a very, very long time, applied their sameness of the sexes theory to sports directly. I mean, I remember, Christian, that I read decades ago this news piece in which they cited two exercise physiologists who claimed that in the 90s, women would overtake men in track and field. And they based this prediction on their analysis of the progression of the sexes' world record times and world records in general. Now, of course, I knew that was not going to happen. I understood why this misunderstanding on their part occurred. But that's just an example of what we're talking about. By the way, in the 90s, the gap between the sexes in track and field actually widened again because of better drug testing. You no longer had those East German women who looked like men out there because they'd been weaned on steroids. But that's just an example of what we're talking about. I mean, I remember Billie Jean King when she actually said, the former tennis star, she used to be number one in the world in the women's tour, when she actually lamented that sports was the one area where boys and girls didn't compete together. So, yeah, this is something the feminists were pushing absolutely up and down.
Absolutely. Selwyn, what do parents do? What can they do? What should they do to shield and guard, protect their children from this made-up sexual status agenda, the MUS agenda, as you refer to it?
Yeah, there's a lot you have to do. First of all, if you can't homeschool or you won't do it, you really have to be aware of what's going on in your child's school, because this is being pushed all throughout the culture. You have to view our culture, unfortunately, today, its elements as guilty until proven innocent if you don't want to be seduced by it. So scrutinize what your children are being told, what's in their textbooks. And then, of course, you always have to have an eye towards truth. Don't fall victim to moral relativism. And understand, this is very important with respect to what we're discussing specifically, that the sexes are inherently different. We know that from the womb to the tomb. Don't fall victim to this ridiculous idea that you have to raise your sons and daughters identically. No, you don't. They're different beings. They're equally valuable, but they have different roles in this world. And so you raise them differently. Now, the left will call that gender stereotyping. But wait a second, that's maybe applying a negative term to something that might be a positive phenomenon. And what I mean is this, Christian. If you have a child who has a proclivity for music, you might guide him differently than a child who has a proclivity for tennis or for baseball. You give them different types of training because they have different interests and inclinations. And this is the same thing. Maybe what they're calling gender stereotyping is actually just providing each sex-specific upbringing that helps the sex to truly cultivate its natural qualities, its natural strengths, its natural virtues. So don't shy away from what the left calls gender stereotyping. It's actually a good thing. We have to get back to tradition. It's leaving tradition, departing from it, that got us into the morass that we're currently in. No, the sexes are not the same. What's been befalling us, it was predictable, it was predicted, and if you want to turn it around, you stop discarding tradition, you re-embrace it.
Well said, Selwyn. Of course, we appreciate always having you on the program, and we hope that parents will heed your advice and talk to younger parents about raising their children in a way that will bring honor and glory to the Lord and not confuse and destroy their children. So thank you so much, Selwyn, for your time. Take care and God bless.
Thank you, Christian, and God bless you.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
And for our final segment, Christian Gomez interviews John Birch Society researcher Peter Rykowski about the Washington Spendathon and what needs to be done to restore fiscal sanity.
This is Christian Gomez for the New American Magazine. I'm here today with Peter Rykowski. So, Peter, what's on today's docket this time?
Well, there's always a lot going on, but today we're going to talk about federal spending, specifically because Congress is right now negotiating the 2024 fiscal year appropriations bills. And the deadline for that is September 30th. So if Congress does not enact the 12 different appropriations bills for fiscal year 2024, then the government will go into a shutdown, which establishment members of the Republicans and Democrat parties, they love to, go hysterical over that. Because how dare we get into a government shutdown?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand. What's the problem?
Well, they don't like limited government. So anything
that restrains their habitual spending habits is a no-no for them. So what are we looking at in terms of next year's budget as they're debating? I mean, this is the first Congress since Paul Ryan was Speaker, that we've had a Republican majority, at least in the House of Representatives now, with Kevin McCarthy. So now that we have Kevin McCarthy at the helm and the Freedom Caucus holding him to the fire, are we going to get spending cuts? Are we going to spend less in 2024 than we spent in 2023? So what's happening, Peter?
Well, if Kevin McCarthy and the establishment Republicans get their way, we're really going to be spending the same amount as last year, which, and by the way, last year was we spent way too much money and we saw massive spending increases in the last 2 or 3 years. But what the establishment Republicans want to do is pass a continuing resolution bill, which would temporarily fund the government at the exact same levels as last year, maybe another 2 or 3 months.
So this is the new definition of conservative. We're going to conserve what the progressive Democrats did last year.
Basically, yeah, yeah.
Wonderful.
Just kick the can down the road.
Thank you, Kevin.
Now, the Freedom Caucus, what they're saying is they will only support a continuing resolution if, for example, there's border security reforms, defunding the weaponization of the federal government through the Department of Justice, defunding the various woke stuff in the Department of Defense. But the Republican establishment isn't very enthusiastic about going along with those demands by the Freedom Caucus. So what they just want is a clean continuing resolution that really just does the same thing, spends the same amount of money, does the same things as the Democrats enacted last year.
One wonders why one would even vote for establishment Republican lawmakers. They seem to be, at least when it comes to the budget, no different than Democrats. They may have different rhetoric, but if they're voting to keep all the spending in place, not even to cut the woke stuff, which was added by the Democrats in recent history, not even to cut the stuff that the Democrats added, is just very, very disappointing. So so it seems like there's probably a schism or a division there within the GOP, with the constitutional conservatives, Freedom Caucus type constitutionalists, and the establishment. So can you tell us more about this division and the differences, and what you expect to come out of the budget debates? Who's going to succeed? Will it be the establishment Republicans, or are the conservatives going to make some inroads, if any?
Well, so there definitely is a schism between the establishment Republicans and more conservative Republicans, for example, in the Freedom Caucus. So the Freedom Caucus, they want very significant spending cuts, repealing many of the increases that we saw during COVID, that we saw during the first 2 years of the Biden administration. So they want to really roll back a lot of this, a lot of these recent spending increases.
Well, that would be very difficult, not to try to go off course of the topic of this video, but in one of our previous segments, we were discussing how they want to bring back all the mask mandates. So could it be? Well, it seems this way, regardless of the motivation. Now, as there's an uptick, so we're told, in cases of COVID and thus the need with that, so the supposed need for mask mandates and vaccine mandates, if now there's a chance that the House Freedom Caucus has a shot of influencing the budget, all of a sudden, oh, no, there's an uptick in COVID. You can't cut that spending. We need that spending now more than ever. Isn't that going to be the mantra of the Biden administration and the House Democrats? They're going to say, you can't cut that at this point. No, no, no.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, as you saw in 2020, really both the Republican and Democrat establishment used COVID as an excuse to massively increase spending with the $2.2 trillion CARES Act. And then the spending bill the year later that spent another $1.9 trillion. And then with...
which inflated the money supply by leaps and bounds, hence the price.
Right, and then...
The increased prices we've seen as a result of this creation of new money injected into the economy circulating.
Right, and then not to bring up yet another topic, but the war in Ukraine was another excuse to spend, you know, about $110 billion just for Ukraine.
All these issues are all interrelated. So speaking about Ukraine... and the budget, what can we expect? What does Biden and the Democrats, what do they want to see included in the budget with regards to Ukraine? And what do the establishment Republicans say about that? And what are the conservative House Freedom Caucus constitutionalists going to do about it?
Yeah, so, well, the Biden administration and the establishment Republicans definitely want to spend many more billions of dollars for Ukraine. So the Biden, requested that Congress spend another, I think, $20 billion for Ukraine in the next budget. Many of the establishment Republicans support that. So there was a vote in the House of Representatives for one of the... So there are many votes that have already happened related to these appropriations bills and, you know, for, like, amendments and similar things like that. And one of them, or actually a few of them, were Ukraine-related. One of them had to do with completely cutting off all funding for Ukraine, and the vast majority of both Democrats and Republicans voted against cutting all funding for Ukraine. There was only a very small handful of Republicans, I forget the specific number, but it was very low, who actually voted for ending all funding for Ukraine.
Well, it's votes like those that separate the men from the boys that are, you know, that we find in the Freedom Index, perhaps not the current Freedom Index, but in future Freedom Indexes, to distinguish who are the constitutionalists and who are the ones going along with the deep state's agenda.
Right, yeah. So there are many members of the Freedom Caucus who want to cut all funding. Marjorie Taylor Greene has said she won't support any bill that includes any more funding. So the Freedom Caucus looks like it'll fight any such funding for Ukraine or for any of these other ridiculous left-wing schemes of the federal government.
So what are the Republican subcommittee chairs saying about cutting spending? Because after all, these budgets, they come out of committee, and the subcommittees and the committees themselves have a lot of influence before it gets to the floor. So what are some of those chairmen and chairwomen saying?
Right, yeah. Many of these chairmen, they're saying openly that they oppose any further cuts to federal spending. And these are Republicans, by the way. So, for example, Mike Simpson of Idaho, Steve Womack of Arkansas, Kate Granger of Texas, she's the chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee. So she's the top representative on the committee. And then also Mario Diaz-Balart of Florida. All of those are on record for saying that they oppose any further cuts. You know, for example, Mike Simpson, he's in charge of the bill funding the EPA, and there have been almost no cuts in that bill, and he's saying that he doesn't want to cut any more funding. So,
well, let's not forget, it was Richard Nixon who created the EPA, so created by Republicans, funded by Republicans.
Right? Yeah, in many cases, they're just claiming that nothing else can be cut, which is ridiculous because there have been many analyses of the bills that these appropriations committees are drafting, and many conservatives have found that there certainly is a lot that can be cut.
So we're really running out of time here. So really briefly, Peter, what spending cuts would you say are most essential that need to be made, and why do they need to be made, and what solutions do you offer to those watching? What can we do to try to stop this crazy spending or to get these significant cuts made?
Yeah, well, the most important thing is to follow the U.S. Constitution, which includes cutting all spending that falls outside of Congress's powers under the Constitution. So to find out those, all you have to do is go to Article 1, Section 8, which clearly enumerates which powers Congress has, and anything not mentioned in Article 1, Section 8, Congress does not have. So really the solution is to follow Article 1, Section 8 and defund any section of the federal government that is not explicitly authorized in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And so that's really important, though, that Congress actually does that and not, pursue these half solutions. And for anyone who wants to cut spending, well, we have an alert, a legislative alert on jbs.org/alerts. It's titled "Slash on Constitutional Federal Spending." And anyone who wants to contact Congress, they can use this alert and they'll easily get in contact with the representative, with their U.S. senators, and they can use that alert to tell them to cut all spending that's unconstitutional. And if Congress actually does that, federal spending would decrease by over 80%.
Well, that's all we got to do then. So if you're watching, do what Peter said. Go to jbs.org/alerts. Look for the federal alert slash unconstitutional federal spending. You should see a picture there of Congress and kind of cut their slashing as it's slashing the spending. Follow that alert and then share it with your friends and family on social media and via email. So thank you so much for your time. Take care and God bless.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. We will see you tomorrow.